evening, everyone. This is host Terry Lynn Coop, and on the grill tonight at the Blue Plate Special is crime author James Littwell, and he's going to be here to tell us about his Detective John Penley books, and we're also going to be discussing things like writing what you know, because his work has been recognized by the Creative World Awards, acclaimed film, and Scriptapalooza television script competition. He specializes in gritty crime fiction, and it's all driven by his two decades of experience working in prisons and jails around the country. He's been an associate warden, chief of institution operations, hostage negotiator, and director of parole. He has stories to tell, and we're here to hear him. How you doing tonight, James?
Good, Terry. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I love how I put in there that I had you in the Scriptapalooza television strip competition, which may have been much more interesting than it actually
that
was.
That would have been much more rewarding than what it actually was, yeah.
Well, you have just put out a new book. Why don't you give us the two minute update of it?
Sure. Bury the Past just came out. It's the second book in the Detective Penley series. Published by Crooked Lane Books. The first book was published last December, At What Cost? And in At What Cost, we are introduced to the detective pair of John Penley and his partner, Paula Newberry. So in Bury the Past, we kind of take their relationship a little further and learn more about Paula in this book. And actually, she kind of takes the lead in this story because, as the title kind of alludes to, Bury the Past. It's a case from her past that comes back and haunts her in this investigation. The basic premise of the book is that John and Paula are out investigating a new homicide, and it turns out it's an ex-cop who's been caught up in a narcotics task force sting, and the only suspect they have is a man who's already in prison. And Paula put him there because he was one of the cops in the narcotics task force. And now everything starts to point at this man who's in prison, but he has the ultimate alibi. And things just kind of unfold from there.
So you talk about that, about this one. You use prison as part of the setting?
I do. There's several scenes in this current book that are in prison. Actually, in one of the prisons that I worked at, the California State Prison, Sacramento, just east of Sacramento, about a half an hour east. It's a maximum security prison. And in the book, we talk about that particular prison and one of its missions, and that's mental health treatment for chronically mentally ill inmates. And our antagonist in this book is one of those inmates.
Interesting. That you've had a fascinating career. Why don't you tell us a little about it?
Yeah, actually, I had fun. Looking back at it now that I'm out of it for a while because I've retired from corrections, I think of it more fondly now than I did when I was there.
Well, yeah.
I started in juvenile hall, working juvenile hall night shifts so I could go to finish my graduate degree in criminal justice. So I'd go and read my criminal justice textbooks at night and do counts and security audits in the juvenile hall. Then I moved to probation. I was a probation officer for a number of years, and then finally ended up in the big house. Went to Folsom State Prison and started my career with the Department of Corrections there.
What did you do at Folsom?
Actually, at Folsom, I was, they call it a correctional counselor. It's a classification specialist that's kind of a hybrid position. It's a peace officer and it's a classification officer. And you kind of drive what assignments, what custody, what classifications the inmates are given at the prison. So if you've got a new inmate coming in, he's serving, 25 to life for murdering a shopkeeper, based on his background, you've got to decide, what kind of assignments in the prison he can go to without creating any security issues or security risks, and what kind of a program he can get himself involved in while he's serving his 25 to life.
Now, to use maybe what people are a little bit more familiar with in terms of, so were you in administration or were you more what would be considered a guard?
It's more the correctional counselor is really considered a line staff. It's in the correctional officer kind of milieu. I mean, especially at Folsom when there's an alarm, you know, officers respond, the correctional counselors respond, and you know we're all kind of in the mix together. So it's very much we're all peace officers and we've all got the same mission, you know, keeping each other safe and keeping the public safe. But yeah, from there I kind of did a whole laundry list of other assignments, from inmate transportation to classification, you know, chief institution operations, and the head of parole for a while. So a little bit of everything.
And hostage negotiator?
Yeah, we would have this on the hostage negotiation team there for a number of years at Folsom.
Well, one thing we talked about before when we were getting ready for this is when you're writing about a prison in your book, like, for example, in the one I'm working on right now, part of it is there's scenes at Mississippi State Prison in Parchman.
I went
Googling and I found that when you drive into the prison, there's this huge billboard that says things like, no hacksaws, picks, chisels, blades allowed. And by statute, and then at the bottom it says by statute. And I was able to work that in. What are some of the things that someone would see when they were going into Folsom?
Well, particularly Old Folsom, it's a very dramatic place to drive up to. I've always wondered, you know, what a convict sitting on a bus, you know, driving up in the middle of the night, seeing these huge granite walls, because you know Folsom was built in like 1880. And mm-hmm. those original buildings are still in use. And it's just a Gothic looking, you know, beautiful structure. But one of the first things that visitors and the staff coming into the prison will see is there's a statement and it's posted and you sign, you know, an acknowledgement that, you know, once you enter the gates, you know, nobody's going to negotiate for your release if you're taken hostage. And that's one of the first things that, you know, legislators will see when they come and make a tour, and they kind of think like, well, wait a minute, you know, you're not going to come and get me, you know, if these guys take me, you know, prisoner. So it's always interesting to see the reactions.
And I've found when I'm going to, when I'm writing about a facility, like I want to add it into, because another facility that I referenced in one of my books was Huntsville in Texas. I'll go to the prison's website. Is that usually a pretty good source of information for someone who out there is maybe writing and wants to put a scene into a book?
I think it's not a bad place to start. If you're living close to one of the prisons that you're trying to write in, I think because many of the prisons will have like at least one or two days a year that they'll open up and have family tours and that kind of thing, so you can kind of get a better feel for the prison. Mm-hmm. In California, I think there's like probably a dozen prisons that have been built since the mid-1980s, and they all pretty much look the same. They're the same design, same, you know, concrete, great concrete walls. So they all pretty much look generic. You know, I mean, the Corcoran housing units are going to look the same as Pleasant Valley, and Pleasant Valley is going to look the same as Mule Creek. So they're pretty generic in terms of their footprint. So if somebody wanted to do, you know, kind of a description of what a housing unit looked like, you could probably get a good deal of that off of a website.
So, but you are able to, I mean, basically you went to your own experiences for this book.
Sure. Yeah, I was able to, you know, draw on some of the places that I had worked, you know, like at California State Prison Sacramento. We mentioned Folsom a little bit in it. But, yeah, some of the operations in the mental health program. And there's a unit called the Psychiatric Services Unit, the PSU, and that's kind of like the highest security placement for a severely mentally ill inmate. So if you've killed an inmate in prison, you go to the security housing unit. If you kill an inmate in prison and you have a psychiatric disorder, you go to the PSU. So you're dealing with people who can't, program in a general population setting. So they're kind of funneled off to this more restrictive and mental health oriented placement.
And again, even as you're speaking about it, you know, you're using a lot of very institutional type terms and that sort of thing. How do you get this into your books and into your stories in a dramatic kind of way? Because as you and I were talking about, you know, particularly you, when you're doing your job correctly, the biggest thing you worry about all day is whether or not you're going to have enough green beans without having to get another order, you know, have another truck brought in. It's controlled boredom.
It is.
And that's actually
considered
to be a good day, is a day
that
you know, green beans were the biggest thing you had to worry about that day. Or that, you know, two of the dryers are down in the, you know, in the laundry room. So what do you draw on to add drama to these actually pretty mundane situations?
Yeah, I mean, the regular day-to-day in prison, and you said it just right, Terry, was, I mean, it can be, you know, boredom punctuated with periods of absolute violence and terror, you know, for minutes at a time. But what I've learned is, in terms of, instead of living it but writing about it, is you kind of have to spoon-feed the details and the procedures to the reader very, very sparingly, because like you said, it's boring. You don't need to know. You don't need to know all the procedures and details to kind of move the story forward that you're writing about. And quite frankly, some editors and readers just don't buy it. You know, they don't believe those kinds of things, you know, can happen in prison. I had a reader one time who was associated with a well-known, popular author. And mm-hmm. she, you know, gave this manuscript that I had to her reader, and it involved a guy walking away from a convict walking away from a minimum security prison. Minimum security, no gates, no fences. It's in low security, and you can kind of just walk away if that's what you choose to do. And the reader and the author were just kind of, you know, flabbergasted that, you know, this can't be possible. It's not true. They're in prison, for God's sakes. They can't just walk away. But, you know, and I tried to, you know, explain a little bit, you know, no, it's true. You know, people really do walk away from fire camps and minimum support facilities. And, you know, it happens. But now they just couldn't get over that process or that idea. So I had to kind of change the project I was working on to come up with this elaborate, you know, guy's working in the metal shop. And so he makes a key to let himself out. And I mean, it just was so crappy. It was just amazingly stupid, but I turned it into a script and screenplay, and that's what I got the acclaimed film award for as a finalist for. But it was bizarre.
Well, no, I can think of back at when I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was working for the prosecutor's office, and they had just built the new jail, and they actually turfed a guy. They like pulled him out of his cell and threw him out the front door. He wasn't supposed to be released for another 30 days. They'd gotten his name mixed up with somebody else. The guy's standing out in front of the jail, terrified, because he's like, I just escaped from, because he actually called the prosecutor's office and he said, I didn't escape. I really didn't. They threw me out the front door. And nobody would believe that actually happened.
Actually, that particular It doesn't happen that often in at least in California, to my experience. It doesn't happen. Our record staff, I mean, they guard the release date like it's, you know, a pit bull with a bone. I mean, they'll call the court.
They do
a really good job of it. And if anything, they'll hold an inmate beyond their release date until they get confirming information back from the committing court, that kind of thing. But releasing prior to the scheduled parole date, that doesn't happen very, very often at all, at least in California.
Well, and again, that's just that sort of thing that, you know, nobody, that actually it shouldn't happen. It was definitely an error. It shouldn't happen, but nobody would believe it. And that's the funny thing, is when you put something to a reader who says, no, there's no way that happened. Well, yeah, actually it kind of did.
Yeah.
But that's your job.
I can see it happening, yeah.
That's your job as the writer to make it real.
Yeah, to make that connection, to make it a little real. In Bury the Past, we kind of skirt that line a little bit, because there's, you know, here you've got your main bad guy in the book is sitting in a jail cell, in a prison cell, but you know he's involved in these murders outside, so how's he getting outside to do this? So you kind of take the reader on this little process of, you know, okay, there's a way to do this, and here's a procedure, and, you know, if there's enough conspiracy involved, and people love conspiracies, you know, then yeah, we can see how this could happen, kind of thing. But it's, you really got to kind of gently spoon feed the reader with those details that could just, you know, just bog a story down or bog the reader down into questioning, and you know, just their whole suspension of disbelief has gone out the window.
And one of my friends said that to me. She's a literary agent. She said what she's looking for is what she calls the tang of authenticity.
Huh.
Meaning, even if it's not 100% the way it does happen, the writer has convinced her that's what happened.
I think that's a really good way to say it. I'm going to have to write that one down. I like that, the tang of authenticity.
So are there going to... The tang of authenticity, yes. So the Bury the Past came out this week. Congratulations, or
yes.
Within the last
Thank
week
you.
Or so.
Right.
And
uh-huh.
so it is available from all in both ebook. Is it in ebook and paperback, or ebook and hardcover?
Ebook and hardcover currently.
Okay, and it's available at our at basically all your fine purveyors of books out there. What are you working on now? Or are you still just in the kind of deep breath stage?
I'd like a deep breath, but no, I'm always working on, you know, two or three projects at a time. I'm just finishing up a manuscript that I'm kind of jazzed about. The basic premise is, you know, it's a guy who paroles from prison after 15 years for a crime he didn't commit. And he goes back home to this town that, you know, basically wanted to lynch him for the death of a young girl there. And his whole focus in life for the last 15 years has been to prove his innocence. And he gets back home and realizes that to do that, he's going to have to basically burn the only people that loved him and supported him for the last 15 years. So, you know, how much is that that redemption worth to him? So.
Oh, that sounds
that
interesting.
Yeah, that one's fun, and then I've got another one that is
dealing
with.
That sounds like a laugh a minute.
Yeah, it's a lighthearted, you know, Christmas mayhem story. Since we're in the holiday spirit, then we've got my agent has one, Liz Crack, who's I think the best agent in the business. She's got a manuscript now that she's going to look for a house for it's a kind of a Mexican drug cartel using illegal immigration as a cover for what they do, and basically how we formed kind of an anti-immigrant, anti-Mexican guy comes to rely on the immigrants coming over for his own life, and kind of turns his perspective on illegal immigration around.
Because you certainly had to deal with a lot of the flotsam and I can't come up with the right word. Obviously, in your job in Sacramento, you had to deal with a lot of gang issues.
Oh yeah, gang issues were big. You know, we had. Well, in the security housing units, the kind of the the most secure facilities in the state, and I worked in a couple of those. We had, you know, all the heavy gang members, you know, the Mexican Mafia, the Aryan Brotherhood, and Nuestra Familia, all of the main shot callers for those gangs were housed in these units. So you kind of get used to the prison politics and the very much the predator and prey kind of relationship that the gangs have with, you know, the inmates who come into the general population and just try to do their time and go home. And there's a lot of pressure put on them by the gangs to, you know, join up and contribute to the cause and get money sent from home and mule weapons and drugs around the prison. So the gangs do have a huge subcultural impact and also a power play impact on the prison operation.
So you've got just a little bit of a little bit of fuel to fuel your future writing.
Yeah, there's a few things there. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, you and I both collaborated on recently was a short story anthology that came out with Betrayed. It's crime survivors stories. It was actually an Authors on the Year publication, and Pam Stack was kind of the guiding force behind that. That
more
project.
Like the guiding, more like the guiding hurricane behind it.
Yeah, no, she was great at pulling these people together, and it's just a great great assortment of writers. And you were probably able to do the same thing, read these stories as they were coming in.
Yes.
There's some dynamite stories in this anthology.
So what's yours about in Betrayed?
In Betrayed, the story is called When the Music Stops. And it's actually based on three women that I knew through probation and later in prison who went to prison for killing their abusive spouses.
Mm-hmm.
The story itself kind of talks about the generational aspects of abuse and domestic violence and how these women had, you know, taken, you know, so much abuse from their husbands to the point where they had no other option in their own mind that other than to kill their husband and then, you know, try to cover it up and try to get back on with life. The first two women that I met who did just that, killed their husbands and, you know, and took them off into the woods and tried to dispose of their bodies. This was in probably the 1980s when, mm-hmm. The whole, really the awareness of domestic violence and battered women syndrome and all those kind of things weren't even thought of yet. So it was very, very new. And I'm coming into this with, you know, just as a probation officer writing a pre-sentence report on a woman who's already pled guilty to, you know, second degree murder, and I'm writing this report up, and it's like, okay, but what did she do that was wrong other than killing her, you know, abuser? it was kind of really a difficult kind of thing to get pulled into. You know, there's a crime. You know, granted, there's a guy that's dead, but, you know, he contributed to that to a large degree. So their story is kind of blended into this into the short story that we have in Betrayed.
That's very interesting, and in mine too. It's a compilation of a couple of clients and cases when I actually did work for legal aid, of the different things that the women had to deal with, like everybody constantly saying, yeah, but she hit him with a brick. Well, she hit him with a brick because he had her down on the ground with his hands around her neck, and she was able to grab the brick to try and get him off of her. But they kept saying, yeah, but she hit him with a brick. And it's like, evidently not hard enough, you know, type of thing. And so it's very interesting. Yes, the Betrayed anthology is a great collection of short stories. And again, people, it brought experience and writers from a lot of different genres and life experiences. Like you and I had more of the criminal justice aspects of it.
Right.
Others were, I mean, it's a complete range. Great, great, great stories.
I really enjoyed yours, Terry. Legal Aid was a really good story, and
well,
it leads off
you.
The anthology, you know, in a very nice way.
And one thing to kind of switch gears, you mentioned this in your blog, and I've seen this on some TV shows that actually surprised me, because I'm from the Sacramento area. I went to school up in Sonora, but I'm from the whole Valley area. Went to school
okay.
in Stockton
yeah.
and everything. Is this thing between Sacramento and serial killers?
Oh yeah,
I never knew that.
Yeah, we're a hub. We kind of specialize in serial killers in the Sacramento area. Recently I got a call from the local ABC News affiliate, and they wanted to do an interview about serial killers. It was on the eve of Charles Manson's death. So, you know, mm-hmm. serial killers were fresh on everybody's mind. And, you know, I went back and looked at some of my information that I've got. And so the Sacramento region, not, you know, the Bay Area, not L.A., not mm-hmm. into Nevada, but Sacramento has hosted 15% of the nation's serial killers.
Jeez.
You know, in the last 20 years. Yeah. I mean, you've got the I-5 killer. You've got Charlene and her husband, Gallegos. You've got Richard Chen Chase. You've got Leonard Solomon, Dorothea Puente, who killed, you know, 9 people that lived in her boarding house. The speed freak killers. Juan Corona wasn't far away, and he killed 25 migrant farm workers just north of Sacramento.
I remember Juan Corona growing up.
Yeah.
So Sacramento, which I consider to be the whitest bred place on the face of the planet, I consider Sacramento, California to be like the least controversial place that I've ever been to.
The least controversial, the most, I call it vanilla, because it's just kind of plain and there's not a lot that draws people here, apparently, other than serial killers, but there's nothing really, you know, that you would say, ah, well, they're going there because of, you know, it's just
it's nice.
There.
Sacramento is nice.
You know, as long as you don't run across, you know, the wrong person.
A serial killer.
You're fine. Yeah.
Was in this analysis and everything, was there anything that came up as to why?
There's nothing definitive on why. There's a couple of theories that, you know, because, well, you're familiar with Sacramento. We've got a couple of major freeways that come through and around the city. You've got I-5 that goes from, you know, the Mexican border through Sacramento, the Canadian border. You've got mm-hmm. Highway 80 that goes, you know, from the Bay Area all the way, you know, through Sacramento to Maryland. And you've got Highway 99 and Highway 50. They all cut across, you know, through Sacramento. And there are some theories that say because there are such an ease in transportation links that killers can use the highway systems to kind of move in and out of the city and do what they need to do. Recently, the FBI has started a specialized unit that's dealing with what they call highway serial killers. And mm-hmm. they're kind of looking at patterns of killers and patterns of murders across the country that are kind of linked around major freeway networks. And there's been like 700 murders across the country that are, you know, that could be attributed to serial killers using the highway systems as kind of a their method of getting to and from their victims.
And as I recall, Juan Corona used the railroads, didn't he?
I think I remember that, yes.
He would hop freight trains out in the farm country.
Right.
And get around that way. That's just interesting. And there's definitely more fodder right there for future writing, to be sure.
There is. I think there's a lot of fertile ground here to dig up a few more stories.
Well, this has been great talking to you. This is your book is fantastic, and I can definitely say that your again, it's that the realism that you bring into it with your experience in corrections. And I know too, being a probation parole officer, talk about you've heard it all.
Yeah.
There is story you have not heard.
Yeah, earlier in my career, and I wish I would have continued it, I used to write down in a little journal, the different excuses that, a parolee or a probationer would have, for having a positive test or not showing up or violating their parole. And I wish I would have kept that up because there were some good ones in there.
Well, on my social media page, I'll do something I call it the crime documentary line of the day. I tend to stream crime documentaries while I'm working, and one that stuck with me that you can appreciate is they call me Cornbread because that's what he was eating when I shot him.
I remember that one. Yeah, that's a great one.
And she was talking about killing her husband. Ed, do you ever find, too, that when we're, like, you and I are having this conversation, that if you start having this conversation around people not in the business, you get that look?
Oh yeah. Yeah, you have to come. I grew up in prison. My dad was a career corrections officer, so some of my earlier memories are by going to pick him up after his first watch shift at San Quentin. Mm-hmm. And so I've been around the prison system and living on grounds for, almost all my life. So, yeah, a couple of us will get together and we'll talk about, a cell search that went bad or something like, an incident that happened on the yard and how you had to put them all down. We stripped them all out. And you realize you're sitting in the middle of, a restaurant and you're talking about an unclothed body search of, 200 guys on the yard. And you look around and there's a bunch of church ladies. And they're just kind of turning blue because you're talking, this blasphemous kind of stuff. But yeah, it's fun.
And though that's great because I've definitely had that same experience and the one of just the different little things I've been involved in too. Interviewing clients in the hallway at the jail, and a guy lunged at me, and the officers were saying later, it's like, we were about to roll out, but you look like you had it under control. And I'm like, it's okay. So I knew you were there. I knew you were there. It's all good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I'd brought him a plea agreement to sign, and it was a good one. But he decided that he didn't like it, and he used some rather choice language, and that's when he lunged at me. And I just stood there, and I said, well, then I guess I'm not your lawyer anymore, and I tore the plea agreement up, and I left. And it was another 6 weeks before he'd get another court date. Oops. So, yeah. But, yeah, see, we can laugh about stuff like that where somebody else might be kind of sitting over there pie-eyed listening to us. Well,
yeah,
keep it up.
It's a different world. Yeah.
Keep it up and keep turning it out into your books because that's what we enjoy and what we're looking for. And will you come back,
Terry,
when you've got another book coming out?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to, Terry.
Absolutely. This was a lot of fun. And thank you very much. And everybody else, check out the new Detective Penley and Newbery novel called Bury the Past. And that's our show tonight. I've got a little bit of boilerplate to go through, so I will say good evening to you, Jim.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming, and I'll be talking to you soon. This broadcast is owned and copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and you can follow the Blue Plate Special on Facebook to stay up to date with who is on the menu. And with that, I will give you all a good night.